This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
That's one of the great things about agroforestry is that it gets farmers out of this loop of growing one or two big crops every year and the possibility that those crops could be ruined from drought or pests or anything.
Occam's razor is a principle that tells us that the simplest solution to a problem tends to be the correct one. Farmers around the world are abiding by this philosophy in droves by practicing agroforestry, an ancient agricultural technique that supports biodiversity while simultaneously sequestering carbon. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn all about agroforestry from Eric Hoffner, an editor at Manga Bay. Hoffner takes a look at examples of agroforestry efforts around the globe, examines recent investments into the sector, and shows how it stacks up to large industrial agricultural systems. As you'll see, sometimes the best answers are right under our noses the whole time. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Eric Hoffner. He is an editor and content strategist for Manga Bay. Eric, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to join you.
I've wanted to have you on the show for far too long. So you've recently written a piece for the Washington Post and have edited a series for Manga Bay on agroforestry. So now you are, like it or not, Manga Bay's resident expert on agroforestry. First, why don't you tell our listeners the definition? What is agroforestry?
So agroforestry is a agricultural technique that combines trees with shrubs and crops all in a system that functions well together. It looks a little bit like a little forest, or it could look like rows of trees that are like fruit or nuts or something like that, and with crops in between them in rows. So it can actually look fairly conventional in some ways. But the typical picture of agroforestry is something like shade-grown coffee or chocolate, which your listeners probably are familiar with. Overstory trees with these taller shrubs growing underneath, and that's what's growing the coffee or chocolate, and that's where they love to be, is in the shade. But then underneath that mid-level canopy, you have things like vegetables or medicinal roots, things that your livestock can forage. All these sorts of things accrue to the system, and it functions really well as a unit, and all the pieces benefit each other, just like a forest.
And it's practiced mostly in equatorial parts of the earth where there is rainforests, and it's also traditional forestry that a lot of indigenous peoples around the planet have used, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's typical in tropical regions, and that's where it really was most prevalent in throughout history. It was developed by indigenous people on all continents, independent of each other, and it's just a wonderful kind of technology that they put together that just by watching what grows in their forest and what they like and encouraging things to grow that benefit one thing or another in their lives. So there's a line of reasoning out there that much of the Amazon forest is actually an agroforestry plot, because people who've lived there for millennia have encouraged certain things in certain ways to grow and has added to some of that diversity that we see.
Now, how does this relate to climate change? If you can kind of give us an idea of why agroforestry is a better form of agriculture than our industrial agricultural system that's prevalent in the United States. I mean, pretty much anything is, but how is agroforestry a viable alternative?
Yeah, it's a sort of agriculture that actually sequesters carbon, whereas our typical kind of agriculture burns up soil and soil carbon at a massive rate and removes all of the all the woody and other kinds of plant biomass off of it every year. So it basically is mining the soil and putting carbon into the atmosphere through how it works on the industrial sort of scale. But agroforestry takes the best of plants and puts them together in a way that builds soil carbon, builds carbon in tree trunks and in shrubs and all manner of things that can take carbon out of the air. So, you know, the point of my Washington Post piece was that it's great that there are inventors out there creating these new ways to bring carbon out of the air with special big fans and catalysts and membranes and things like this. But these are still inventions in the discovery phase. You know, they're seeking investment to bring it to a place where it can be scaled up. And my point in the piece was, that's great. We probably need that. And why don't we also have much more agroforestry in the world? And not only in the tropics, but it can be done in the temperate regions too. And places like Kyrgyzstan and the U.S., for example, we just had a feature from California. But in Europe, there are agroforestry projects, people who farm this way. So as a way of mitigating carbon in the atmosphere, it's pretty powerful. The authors of a Nature study recently published in the journal Nature estimated that there's 45 gigatons of carbon currently sequestered in agroforestry systems worldwide, and that figure grows by 0.75 gigaton each year based on their calculation.
What does that mean exactly, that sequestered carbon?
It's taking the carbon out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, other carbon gases, and locking them up into the cambium, the roots, the soil horizons, and they're not available to the atmosphere to drive climate change anymore, you know, unless that is converted to back to regular agriculture, of course.
So just the mere existence of agroforests removes carbon from the atmosphere. Is that correct?
That is a good general statement. And one of the caveats that's important is to say that it's definitely not cool to cut down a natural forest and then to plant an agroforestry plot. That's a net loss. You know, all those trees, all the biomass underground, that's all going to go in the atmosphere, but also it's just going to be less diverse. So there's, you know, an acknowledgement that we can't cut down the world's forests and make agroforestry, because that wouldn't make any sense. But the world has an amazing amount of degraded pasture land, desertified farmland, and areas where deserts are actually expanding, where you can plant trees that are drought tolerant, and then you can start growing things right underneath it. And that's one of the things, you know, that's why it works so well in the tropics, is the, you know, the sun can be so intense, and just a little bit of shade can make all the difference. You can grow cabbages, you can grow wheat or millet if you have a little bit of shade. The second thing that really helps is that these trees and shrubs, that some of them fix nitrogen, for example, but also they have long tap roots, and they will be bringing up groundwater from far below that's not available to, say, wheat or maize. But then it becomes available when the trees around them start using it. So they lose less through evapotranspiration because they're not standing in the direct, crazy tropical sun all the time, but also they just are getting more of a benefit from below.
And how long does that usually take, the whole regeneration process of these desertified lands that you're talking of? How, can we just take fully grown trees and plant them, or is that not a viable solution?
Not too viable, but yeah, tree saplings, and some of these trees grow very fast. Obviously, banana palms, plantains, things of this nature are early components of many agroforestry systems in tropical areas. But then amongst them are planted everything from nut trees to mahogany, even, you know, things that farmers know that they can sell for lumber, for wood, that becomes part of their overall economy. And that's one of the great things about agroforestry, is that it gets farmers out of this loop of growing one or two big crops every year, and the possibility that those crops could be ruined from drought or pests or anything, whereas the bananas may get some sort of fungus, but you're still getting all of the things that are growing in the fish pond between the rows of bananas and the different vegetables that are growing under the nut trees. That whole scenario gives rural communities and the farmers that make up these communities much more resilience in the face of things like market forces, but also climate change.
Time is getting shorter, and there's much for you to do. Only asking you what you are needing, the rest is up to you. Your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Eric Hoffner. He's an editor at Manga Bay. So, Eric, take us around the world. Manga Bay's journalists have done profiles on agroforestry practices in many countries. Why don't we start with, let's say, Kenya?
Sure. Yeah, we've covered almost 20 countries at this point, this part of the series. We've been looking at the Rift Valley in Kenya quite a bit. In these areas, people are growing home gardens, is one word for it. A home garden is it's basically an agroforestry plot that it's intentionally created. And there's a number of things in there, but one of the main things will be avocados. They're very profitable, and they can even be sold for export in some cases. But what these systems we're looking at are pretty far removed from cities, and you know, people are selling and eating these products locally. Also, crops like enset, which is an ancient version of the banana, looks much like it, but it grows really well there. It's a native crop there, and it looks like a small banana, and they are able to make a great meal out of that. It's not like a fruit, it's more of a grain. And then underneath that we have cabbages, we have different sorts of shrubs that flower year-round that bees love. So farmers typically get into raising bees as well. And there are some fodder crops as well, these shrubs that people grow for the shading benefit for their coffee and for the chocolate that's also underneath these other things. But the fodder from these other trees are harvested, and you know, the leaves and twigs are brought to goats or cows or whatever kind of livestock they have. So you can kind of start to see all the benefits that people are going to be getting out of an agroforestry home garden in, say, Kenya, not to mention the medicines and the other valuable things. And another thing I should mention is that a lot of these agroforestry systems provide fiber crops, things that you can weave baskets or roofing materials out of. And that's another fantastic thing. Resins is another one, rubber trees, but also damar in Indonesia and Southeast Asia. These crops are, you know, they're tapped off of trees and collected, and then the resin is sold. So there are many different ways that people are doing it. And I'd like to just mention, in terms of the biodiversity of these things, this is a whole other important benefit of agroforestry. Home gardens, like in Kenya, are these diverse, you know, it looks like a forest if you don't know what you're looking at. You think you're looking at a forest, but in reality, It's not, of course, but lots of birds and monkeys and all manner of reptiles and things live in there as well. And there was a great study done in Indonesia that is a good example. They looked at someone's home garden, and this is, they call it a home garden because it's just the agroforestry plot that's right outside your back door. And these are homes probably set inside a rainforest, generally. And researchers studied the biodiversity of the rainforest, and then they studied the biodiversity of the home gardens, and they found that the home gardens contained up to 70% of the total biodiversity in the actual rainforest right next door. So these animals are coming into agroforests and making homes, making nests, chewing on fruit, using them as corridors from one core area to another. So there's a biodiversity benefit as well to these systems.
So instead of going through all these different countries, you've mentioned a couple, but from Sri Lanka to Kenya to Venezuela, Kyrgyzstan, Honduras, El Salvador, what are some of the common threads that connect these agroforests beyond just tree cover?
You mean like the what they look like and how they function?
Yeah, and the practices. I guess that kind of gets at the root of, no pun intended, the root of what an agroforest is. Like, how are they all agroforests? Is this just shade agriculture? It's more than that, isn't it?
It is more than that, and people are intentionally growing things in combination that they know will benefit each other. In places like Africa, where you're typically working with poor soil, you really need to bring in the nitrogen-fixing trees, the legumes that can help build the soil and help you grow grains between the rows of trees that you have, for example. So it's almost impossible to say that there's a common thread, except that everyone is looking at all the possibilities for what can be grown together.
Why don't you kind of give us a glimpse of how agroforestry has been adopted on these shores? Where are the American agroforestry practitioners?
Sure, good question. I think we, as Americans, probably know the term permaculture, and that kind of gets at where much of this is located at this point. People study permaculture, and this is a way of creating a system on a piece of land to, you know, use all of the aspects of your land, all the benefits of it, in a way that creates food and also just value for the grower, creates a kind of a holistic system. And many permaculture homesteads or businesses really are highly based in agroforestry, as well as rainwater harvesting and creating biochar, all different kinds of things like this. But what's interesting is that besides the personal practitioner, you know, after I published this article for the Washington Post, I got regional planners and people from land trusts calling me and emailing me and saying, "Hey, I love that. What can we do around here? Let's talk about it." And so we're going to have a conversation around what that would look like here, because there are areas that could be preserved that are on their radar that they think would be interesting. And, you know, around here, we would probably grow things like timber trees, but also edible mushrooms underneath on logs from harvested from limbs from those trees. We would grow golden seal, which is a fantastic medicinal ginseng. These are all highly marketable products. However, you know, this is all conceptual because it's been largely a tropical kind of tradition. But, you know, even in your state there, Alex, of California, we just did a profile of the Karuk and the Yurok tribes up in Northern California who are using prescribed burning and agroforestry to change their forest in a structure in a way that makes it them less prone to massive wildfires while encouraging more things like huckleberries and acorns and weaving materials and elk and salmon. Their system creates a more healthy system, which even can benefit the salmon. So it can be done in regions like ours.
And how scalable is this? Do we have any big agribusinesses who have expressed interest in evolving their practices to be more sustainable? Or is this going to be just small outcroppings of farmers doing the right thing versus the big industrial farmers?
The best example I can give you at the moment, I think, is the Cocoa and Forests Initiative, which is, it's based in the cocoa-producing countries of Ivory Coast, Colombia, and Ghana. These are three powerhouses of cacao production, and they're partnering with these large chocolate companies that do business there to ensure that their products are deforestation-free, so that, you know, they're not coming in and removing the native forest cover and just growing rows and rows of chocolate. However, they, you know, so these companies that they're working with, and I don't have a list and I wouldn't want to name any of them, but so they're making a commitment to deforestation-free chocolate. But part of how they're going to deliver on these commitments, it looks like, is going to be through agroforestry as well. Some NGOs that I'm in touch with, their staff are saying that there's a race on now to figure out how to help these big corporations roll out agroforestry-based chocolate between now and the end of 2019, which is when this Cocoa and Forest Initiative is going to come into play.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Eric Hoffner. He's an editor at Manga Bay. So beyond just the logistics of farming in scale, what about the money behind that? Is there capital pouring in to back agroforestry initiatives, Eric?
Yes, there is, and there's a lot of interest. I interviewed one of my key sources a couple of years ago, and he was inundated afterwards with private investors saying, where do we put our money? This sounds fantastic to us, because so far, most of the effort in scaling agroforestry is done by big NGOs or UN-style bodies like the World Agroforestry Center or the FAO, and they provide training and seeds and young trees and advice, support, but not as much for the capital side. But there is more that can be done with private money, because, you know, it is cheaper to do this than to just throw all our money into the kind of Wall Street-backed carbon-sucking technologies that we don't even have yet. And for example, Project Drawdown, which is the carbon solution tracking initiative that Paul Hawkins started, they estimated a cost of about $26 billion to implement agroforestry on an additional 19 million hectares globally. You know, and right now, estimates are that we have maybe up to 1 billion hectares of agroforestry global, which is about the size of Canada. But you could put another 19 million hectares on there for about $27 billion. And that would sequester another 9 billion gigatons of carbon. And they estimate that the profit for farmers and investors would be over $700 billion by 2050. So, and they like to be pretty conservative, I've noticed, at Project Drawdown. So these look like really interesting numbers to me. You're throwing on numbers like 26 billion. It sounds like a lot, but I don't think it sounds like a lot when you're thinking about scaling, you know, say huge carbon sucking machines around the entire Earth.
Yes, you, in your Washington Post article, you mentioned the Southern Company's carbon capturing power plant in Mississippi, and that's supposed to, it was originally forecast to cost $2.2 billion to build. Now it's going to cost around $7.3 billion to complete. It's hard, obviously, to do an apples-to-apples comparison, but in terms of carbon removal, in terms of how much a carbon capturing power plant helps climate change versus a large-scale agroforest initiative like Project Drawdown, there's more to it than just the price tag.
Sure. The problem is it's hard to know how much they are able to draw out of the atmosphere since it's all very experimental still.
Yeah, that's an important point. This isn't even proven technology, right?
Yeah, and they're like the best one for numbers is Carbon Engineering. They got all this press this summer saying that they could pull carbon out of the atmosphere for $100 a ton or something like this. But we don't really know how that equates to forests, you know, because forests in the tropics grow fast and they grow more slowly in temperate regions and different trees do different things. But, you know, what we do know is agroforestry is extremely cheap compared to this. You know, the main inputs are education, seeds, and follow-up, you know. The only metal you're digging out of the earth to create a massive amount of tools with is for shovels and grafting tools and things like this. You know, we're not talking about, you know, precious metals and, you know, things like this that you need for catalysts. And so I think you will find that it's not the same value proposition between agroforestry and these large technologies.
Well, just comparing agroforestry practices to industrial agriculture, in terms of water usage, I can imagine that as we see more and more of American Western farmland becoming almost desertified with global warming, having a shade-oriented approach sounds prudent, doesn't it?
It sure does. And it's what we used to have with the shelter belts. And that was one of the things that helped with the Dust Bowl. But in recent years, farmers have been incentivized to cut those tree-lined shelter belts down and plant row, hedgerow to hedgerow, as they say. And so we've lost even more soil and that carbon associated with it.
And do you think there's a chance that that can come back?
I think so. I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, there's a farm in the upper Midwest that's using dwarf hazelnuts in rows like this and growing grains between them, you know, in the width of a tractor so you can drive up and down and harvest grains and the whatever you're growing between those rows is benefiting both from the shade and the windbreak, but also any soil building that those hazelnuts can do.
Well, terrific. I highly recommend people go read the whole series on Manga Bay. We will link to it on Sea Change Radio. Eric Hoffner. Eric, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Maceo and the Max, Eric Clapton, and the Beatles. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.